Good. Shall we begin? Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahavityam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. All right, let's recite a few sutras, beginning with 43. Sutra 43. Dusangaha, dusang, sarvathaiva tyajaha, sarvathaiva tyajaha, kama krodha moha, kama smriti bhramsha buddhinasha, Aranatvat Tarangaita Api Me Sangat Samudrayante Kastarati Kastarati Mayam Yas Sangam Tyajyati Yajati Yo Mahanubhavam Sevate Nirmamo Bhavati Yo Vivektasthanam Sevate Yo Loka Bandhumunmulyati Yo loka bandhamun mulyati nistrai gunyo bhavati yoga kshemam tyajati yah karma palam tyajati karmani sanyasyati Tato nirdvandvo bhavati Vedanapi sanyasyati Kevalam avichinnanuragam Labhate Sattharati Sattharati Salokan sthārayati. Very good. We have a nice topic this evening, and we'll see several threads come together. It almost stands out as an independent topic, starting with verse 46. We finished 45 in a prior session, so we'll just move right ahead with 46. Let's return to it, please. Kastarati, kastarati mayam. Yas sangam tyajati. Yo mahanubhavam sevate. Nirmamo bhavati. This is an unusual sutra. It strikes me as the entire teaching. The whole thing you can find in one sutra. We could spend our whole lifetimes on this one sutra. And it really introduces it very nicely. It says, kaha tarati mayam. Kaha tarati. Kaha who tarati crosses mayam. This world of suffering. Who crosses suffering? Who gains freedom from a life of suffering? Maya here represents the struggle, the suffering, the difficulty of life. So he says, kaha tarati mayam. Who is it that can free themselves from maya? Phrasing the prototypical spiritual question. How to gain freedom, how to gain moksha, and as we'll see by the end of the sutra, how to gain para prema bhakti. They all ending up being the same, moksha. And his answer is in three parts. These three parts seem to form the three primary elements of one's spiritual life. This is why the sutra seems so complete. So how does one, or who crosses? So what is the nature of the person, the qualifications, the qualities of a person who can cross Maya, who can gain freedom? What should that person have? Or how should that person be? He says, it's a person, yaha, who, sangam tyajati. We just give it literally first. A person who, tyajati, gives up sangam, attachment. Attachment to the world. Pretty obvious. As long as you're attached to worldly things, what will be your interest or value in spiritual life? We've discussed many times that human behavior is such that we pursue what we find is valuable. Period. It's an oversimplification, but it's actually a pretty profound statement to recognize that whatever we do in life reflects our values. It's true. It's all the way true. So we live a life pursuing what is valuable, and you'll find that what's valuable to you varies at different points in your life. When we're children, what's valuable to us is playing with our friends and being loved by mommy and daddy. When we're a little older, what's important shifts, professional things come, family things come, many things come. So whatever is valuable to us at a particular point in our time, particular point in our lives, we pursue. And obviously other things we leave behind. To leave other things behind is to be free from sangha. It's that easy. You can't give up attachment. If I sit up here and tell you, give up all your attachments, and I try to find 20 ways to tell you to give up all your attachments, by the end of the class, I'll be exhausted and out of breath, and your life won't change one iota. Because telling you to give up attachment means what? I'm telling you to give up desire. Can you give up desire? Is it a matter of will? Is it a matter of choice? Certainly not. So whenever a text of scripture tells us to give up attachment, we have to put it in the right context. How do we get out of attachment? In a way, it's through developing another attachment. You give up an attachment to worldly enjoyments by developing an attachment to spiritual growth. There is a weird metaphor that's given in some text. I think in one of Shankaracharya's, maybe Vivekachudamani or someplace, where he talks about this little worm crawling on a blade of grass. How to get from one blade of grass to the other blade of grass? I mean, they're very far apart. Just as far apart as worldly life and spiritual life are very far apart. So how does one let go? How does a worm, what a funny example, how does a worm let go of this? The worm can't fly through the air, at least not so far as I know. So apparently what the worm does is he crawls to the top of the blade of grass. Now that seems so counterintuitive. Except as he crawls to the top of the blade of grass, it starts to bend over with his weight. Until finally, that blade of grass is touching the next one. And then the worm crawls off of this blade of grass and crawls on to the next one. So how does he get off of this blade of grass? Not by jumping, but by attaching himself to the next blade of grass. Kind of a funny example given by Sri Shankara someplace. I have no idea where, I don't remember. But this is the idea of how do we get rid of attachments, not through somehow willfully giving them up. Even the rituals of sannyasa, when you throw everything in the Ganga, and then you throw yourself in the Ganga, and you say the vows of renunciation, renouncing everything, and you come out, have you renounced your desires? Have you renounced your attachments? In all honesty, whatever desires and attachments a sannyasi goes into the river with, after the vows, comes right back out with them. You cannot give up attachment through an act of will. However, we regularly get rid of attachments. As we've said, there are so many things you were attached to as children. We're no longer attached to those things. Why? We're attached to new things. You get rid of your attachment to old toys by getting attachments to new toys. Now the latest new toy is this 84-inch LCD high-definition TV. This is it, or plasma TV. This is a new toy. How to give up attachment to all toys, which means all worldly life, and it's to recognize the value of spiritual growth, to develop an attachment to spiritual growth. Nothing wrong with saying that. Attachment to a good thing is good. To be attached to spiritual growth leads you out of all attachment. So, sangam tyajati, one who gives up attachment by developing a value for spiritual growth. One yaha mahanubhavam sevate. Yaha sevate, one who sevate worships or resorts to is a better translation. Serves, it can also mean, but resorts to is a better translation here. One who resorts to a maha anubhava. One whose anubhava experience is mahan, is great. One of great experience. It's a common expression for our elders, our teachers, our gurus in particular. Are those who have much experience, much wisdom. Wisdom to share with us. This is really the key to mature life, if we want to come up in life. I guess we have several options at our disposal. We're bound to make mistakes. So you can go on making mistakes and learning from our mistakes, as we do. How to come up in life? We can learn from our mistakes. And of course, here I have to share with you this weird theory of learning. Some of you heard this before. We learn from our mistakes. Any intelligent person, we learn from our mistakes. And the more mistakes we learn, the more we learn. And by extension, whoever makes the most mistakes must know the most. You think so? Perhaps in theory, but you've all figured out long ago that maybe there are better ways of learning. For example, learning from the mistakes of others, we need not repeat them if we learn from the mistakes of others. So that's what a mahanubhava is, one who has great experience, one who has either made all the mistakes or one who has learned from others' mistakes, one who has gone before us, one who is wise, one who can give us guidance. Mahanubhava. Can you... Yeah, a question that's asked all the time. This literally says you should resort to a guru. Mahanubhava here means guru. And the question is asked again and again, is it truly necessary to have a guru in spiritual life? I'm puzzled why this question is asked again and again and again. What is this mania with do it yourself? When your car is broken, are you going to ask your auto mechanic, do you think I could fix it myself? You would never ask. Why? It's pretty complicated and difficult. What is the auto mechanic going to say? He says, well, I don't know, maybe you could, but I don't know, why bother? Just let me help you. In the same way, when somebody asks me, is it necessary to have a guru? I feel like that auto mechanic, it seems so impractical in a very simple way. Why do things on your own when there are skillful people around to help you? Do you really want to spend all that time dinking around on your car, getting covered from head to toe in grease, Getting your knuckles all banged up and skinned up. Those of you who have done it know what I'm talking about. The cars bite. When you're working on them, your hands and arms get injured as you're rubbing up against metal pieces. It hurts. And besides the fact that automobile engines and cars are pretty complicated, can you learn all of that? Sure. Your auto mechanic learned. If the auto mechanic learned, you can also learn. But come on. Isn't it just common sense that the auto mechanic is standing there? Of course, he's going to charge you, but it's a lot easier than the alternatives. In the same way, actually, the guru is, at least one good thing about the guru is he or she won't charge you anything. At least you won't get a bill. There still is some responsibility to support. We understand that, but you won't get a bill. But once again, it's so pragmatic and practical. Why should we reinvent the wheel on our own? Is it possible to get enlightened without a guru? Sure. Go for it. But isn't that really doing things the hard way? Do you really like to do things the hard way? Who wants to do things the hard way? Any intelligent person is going to take advantage of whatever resources are around. Now, if you ask me, is it necessary to have a guru? I say, certainly not. Have as many as you like. Is it necessary to always go to the same auto mechanic? No. On the other hand, if you find an auto mechanic that does a good job, then it makes sense to keep going back to him. Can we not be a little practical about this issue? All right. So it says, Yaha Mahanubhavam Sevate, one who seeks out the help of a Mahanubhava, one who has great experience, one who has wisdom, a guru, one who can offer guidance. Finally, Nirmamaha Bhavati. Is that it? Yeah. Nirmamo Bhavati, Nirmamaha Bhavati. That person, Bhavati, becomes Nirmama. Free from Mamata. Mama is a pronoun, my. Mamata, myness. Nirmama. Free from the pronoun, my. Free from possessiveness, I suppose it might be translated. But that's a pretty inadequate translation. If you're looking for one English word, you might try free from possessiveness. But what does it really mean to be free from mama, to be free from my? You know, isn't it necessary? Isn't it natural? You know, just think, in your life, there are many things that are yours. Your house, your car. If you want to be free from mama, free from my, I suppose you can give up your car. Therefore, it's not your car, somebody else's car. You can give up your house. You can sell it. You can give it back to the bank. Therefore, it's not your house. You can give up your possessions. You can give up your furniture. You can, if you want to, you can give up your family, your children, whatever it is. You can give all this up. When will you be free from mama? You don't have all of that, but are you free from mama? Because then you have mama deha, my body. It's not exactly something you can give up, at least not in this lifetime, not while living. And beyond mama deha, my body, what about mama buddhi? My intellect, my mind. So what does it mean to be free? A mistranslation would be to be free from possessions. But as I said, you can give away your house, your car, even your family. You can't give away this body and mind, so you're going to be stuck with mama. You'll be stuck with mama as long as there's an aham. A little bit of grammar, two pronouns. Aham, first person singular, I. Mama is the genitive singular, my. Aham and mama. And here's a principle. Mama will be present whenever a hum is present. How to get rid of mama? To get rid of a hum. Ultimately, that's the only way to get rid of mama. Because what is the enlightened person's relationship with possessions? Can an enlightened person drive, own a car? Is there any rule? All right. An enlightened person can own a car. The enlightened person might even say, this is my car. You know, if you asked that enlightened person, is this your car? What will he say? No. He's going to say, it's my car. Then how can he be free from mama? He or she, that enlightened person, how are they free from mama? They're free from I. We're going to talk about this in just a moment. Therefore, their use of the word mama is kind of conventional. It's just an expression with no real hooks to it. Here is a little bit of Vedanta. We better get it quickly. The issue with mama is whatever is mine affects me. If it's my car and it gets stolen, it's a problem. If it's your car and it gets stolen, it's your problem, not mine. So it's a problem for me if it's my car. If it's my house, it's a problem. If it's my family, it's my problem. If it's my body, my mind, these are all sources of problem. Whatever you possess is a source of problems. Think about that again. Anything you possess certainly can be a source of enjoyment. There's no question. Your house is a source of enjoyment. Your car, your family, many things, and most of the things you possess are a source of enjoyment. But isn't it equally true those same things are a source of suffering? Your car, when it breaks down, becomes a source of suffering. Your house, when it's in need of major repairs, becomes a source of suffering. Your family, when there are some problems, becomes a source of suffering. Your profession, your body when it's ill, your mind when it's upset, anything and everything you possess becomes a source of suffering. At some times. How to be free from suffering? Well, can you divest yourself of all possessions? We went through that. Body and mind, you can't divest yourself of. Therefore, how to be free from mama, how to be free from possessing anything which is a source of suffering? And the answer is ultimately to be free from aham, I. When the ego, the ahankara, is finally removed, and we're talking about the condition of enlightenment, when that false sense of individuality is finally destroyed. This is the culmination of all of these teachings, as we'll see in just a few minutes. When that ego is destroyed, ahankara, sense of individuality, this is how you become nirmama. This is enlightenment. This is moksha. And you'll find that this is true across several traditions, we'll see in just a moment. Before we do, just to make that point a little bit more clear, when we say aham and mama, these are pronouns. Pronouns refer to some kind of other reality. So what do these pronouns refer to? Let's look at the pronoun aham, since that's the one that's ultimately the issue. What is I? You've been to our Vedanta classes here and elsewhere, and you know well enough that the final meaning of I is the consciousness behind your thoughts, behind your mind, behind every experience, the consciousness by which this experience is known, the consciousness by which all experiences are known. And that consciousness happens to be sat, uncreated, unchanging, and ananda, full, complete, limitless. This is sat chit ananda. This is atma. This is the true self. When you use the word I, aham, are you referring to that one exactly? Not usually. When you say, I came to the ashram, you mean Satchitananda Atma got into a car and drove here? I didn't know Atma had a driving license. Sorry for the bad joke. You get the point that when you use the word I, aham, in common parlance, it doesn't refer to Atma at all. It doesn't refer to you. Is that strange or what? When you use the pronoun I, you use it to refer to what's not you. That's awfully strange. If I started referring to this chair as I, wouldn't you think that's funny? You'd think it was awfully strange. You'd think, boy, what happened to poor Swamiji? He's always a little strange, but tonight he has really gone off. Well, it's so obvious that this chair is not I, but tell me, this thing of flesh and bone is not so terribly different from the chair, yet it's referred to as I. It's a thing. And to reflect on our Vedanta 101, our basic principles of Vedanta, drik drishya viveka, this understanding the difference between the awareful subject and the inert objects, anything known to you is an object and therefore not you. The chair is known to me, therefore it's not me. And if I call it me, I'm in trouble. My body is known to me, therefore it's not me, yet I call it me. My senses are known to me, they're not me, yet I call them part of me. My mind, my intellect, my emotions are known to me. Therefore, they're not me. But what do I call them? These are all parts of me. This is delusion. It's as deluded as to say this chair is me. That's no joke. To say this chair is me is delusion. To say the body is me is equally delusion. To say the mind or personality is me, this is all delusion. This is all avidya and adhyasa, its ignorance and its effects. This is the problem. So the me that we're talking about is false. When you use the word I or me or my, it refers not to the true you, consciousness. It refers to a false you. That false you we call ahankara or ego. All right. This is just a little quick review of some Vedantic principles. So, what is this last of the three steps in the sutra? The nirmama bhavati. You be free from mama. You're free from I. You're free from this false ahankara, this false I, this false ego. All right, enough said. Now, before we move ahead, there's something very interesting to see how this sutra encompasses the whole spiritual journey. Three giant steps. Step one, he says, to be free from sangha. I'll stay with all Roman letters tonight. To be free from sangha. That expression indicates the the first step of spiritual life, which is to recognize the limitations of worldly life and to recognize the value of spiritual growth. Again, we pursue what is valuable. So when you discover the value for spiritual growth, your spiritual life begins. Not until then. You won't pursue it if it's not valuable. So we begin by having a value for spiritual growth. Then you seek a Mahanubhava. What this indicates is that in the pursuit of this value, the value in pursuit of spiritual growth, we're going to need some guidance as we undergo this process of spiritual growth. So we seek guidance in many, many forms, and we undergo that sadhana. Finally, that sadhana culminates in being nirmama, free from I-ness, and let's talk about this. This is, we've been holding off on talking about surrender. It's a tricky subject, and it's absolutely central in understanding what bhakti is about. Also, it's a way of seeing how bhakti fits together with Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta, and even with yoga. Let's go through this a little bit together, and you're going to see something quite nice, I think, I hope. What did I say? Do here. This nirmama, as we just discussed, destroying the false I. This is the culmination. This is really the goal. So here's the first step of the journey. First step of the journey is deciding to go on a journey. Think of the journey of spiritual life. First step is you have to decide to walk out the front door. And it's been said many times, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with that very first step. There it is, the very first step. So that's step one, is developing a value for spiritual growth. Step two is everything that comes in between, the whole journey, which requires a guidance. And then what about the journey must culminate in your arrival at the goal, in this case, that's becoming free from the false I, false ego. This is actually expressed in different terms in three different traditions. Let's compare them briefly. We're going to compare the position of Advaita Vedanta, Yoga Darshana, Yoga Darshana specifically being the system of Patanjali, the whole methodical process of yoga as taught by the Rishi Patanjali. And finally, bhakti, since that's our current subject matter. Let's look how these play out. And all three of them somehow have to culminate in the same goal. Because they're all processes of spiritual growth. Spiritual growth has one goal, not many. So let's find out how can these all progress to the same goal. And we can look at the words used in each of these traditions for the means. Let's use the Sanskrit terms. Sanskrit terms are sadhana. Sadhana, as you know, is the means, and sadhya. sadhya, as you also know, is the goal, the end. Sadhana is a means to get there. Sadhya is a goal. Okay. We are ready. Now we're ready. So, in Advaita Vedanta, we understand that the problem is ignorance of one's true nature already being non-separate from Brahman. Atma is already non-separate from Brahman. You don't know that. You don't recognize your true self. You have ignorance. Because of this ignorance, you suffer. Because of this ignorance, that false I comes up. As soon as a false I come up, then it's my body, and whatever happens to the body is a problem. It's my mind and intellect. Whatever happens to my emotions is a problem. It's my house. It's my car. It's my family. And whatever happens to my house, car, or family becomes a problem for me. This is the source of all the problems. The problems then begin with the non-recognition of my true nature, Atma being non-separate from Brahman, and therefore, since the problem is ignorance, this is Vedanta, since the problem is ignorance, the means, the solution, can only be jnana, knowledge. This jnana solves the problem how? This is trickier than you think. Remember, Atma already is Brahman. What new thing do you get out of Brahma Vidya? You already are it. In a very real sense, you're not getting anything new. What is the value of this knowledge is what it gets rid of. It gets rid of the ignorance that leads to suffering. The ignorance in the form of that false I. As long as that false I is present here, then it's my body. And when the body is ill, I'm in bad shape. It's my mind and emotions. When my emotions are hurt, I'm in bad shape. It's my house, car, and family. When there's a problem with any of them, I'm in bad shape. All suffering begins with that false I. How does knowledge yield its result here? Not by bringing something new to you, but by destroying suffering, by destroying the root of the suffering. What is the root of the suffering? The false I. So we could say that how jnana leads to the goal is through the sadhya here, the object here, as we use the word ahankara nasha. Ahankara is that false I. Nasha means destruction. Then, what is the approach taken in Yoga Darshana? Bear in mind, all three of these traditions come from the same ancient rishis. So almost all of the presuppositions are the same. Details are different, plenty different. But the basic teachings, the basic structure is the same. And you're going to see something in just a moment here. It's surprising how similar they look. Of course, the goal of Yoga Darshana is not jnana in an Advaitic sense. You know, they practice meditation. Yoga is all about meditation. And through meditation, what are you seeking? Samadhi. Not just any kind of samadhi. Actually, Patanjali gives, I think, six or eight different kinds of samadhi. So he gives these different forms of meditation and states of absorption called samadhi. But the goal of these kinds of samadhi, or the way these kinds of samadhi prepare you for reaching the goal here, is he has a very interesting term. You may not have seen this term before unless you studied the sutras and commentaries. Para-vairagya. Vairagya is a term you already know. Vairagya means dispassion. But here, it's para-vairagya. Now, don't think of para-vairagya as just lots of dispassion. It's a very different kind of dispassion. Generally, we take dispassion towards objects and things in the world. How about when you can become dispassionate not only towards your mind and body? Can you become dispassionate towards your own mind and body?
Sure.
Remember, in samadhi, in meditation, you come to discover that you are full and complete without regard to the body. Every time you close your eyes in meditation, you're in a state of bliss. What do you need the body for? The body is a nuisance, so even the mind is a nuisance. In meditation, the more you get rid of the mind, the better you feel. It's very odd. Quick comment here. What does that tell us? In meditation, the more successful you are at stopping your mind, the better you feel. So therefore, the mind is a source of headaches. Headaches and headaches. We mistakenly think the mind is a source of happiness. Mind is a source of headaches. Every yogi discovers this in meditation, because whatever headache they have when they sit down to meditate, as soon as they're in samadhi, gone. No headaches. So, suppose with this practice of meditation, one develops a dispassion, not just for the body, not just for the mind, intellect, memories, experiences, even for the false I. This is part of vairagya, is to be dispassionate towards the false I, is to know that there's no happiness to be found through that false I, the true source of happiness, contentment, and peace, being one's own true nature. This is what leads in Yoga Darshana to the goal. The goal, they have a very interesting term. You may have heard this term, Kaivalya. Kaivalasya bhava iti kaivalyam. The condition of, literally it means, the condition of being only. Kaivala means only. Kaivalya is the state of being only. What does that mean? It means that in meditation, in samadhi, there's only the true you. There's only consciousness, chit, chaitanya, utterly nothing else. So this kaivalya then is definitely a condition where you are freed once again from that false I. Just as in Advaita Vedanta we use knowledge to destroy the false I, in Yoga Darshana, Patanjali's system of meditation, we use meditation to destroy the false I, ahankara. What about bhakti? Finally. Well, in bhakti, we use our, we called it sadhana bhakti. We called it prema bhakti. All of the means. And the word that's going to come a little bit later is anuraga. Anuraga means love. Anuraga, love, obviously love towards Bhagavan. How does this work? if the problem of suffering is due to the presence of this false I, this ego, ahankara, then how does love ever exterminate this false I? Well, two ways of answering that. If any of you have had the very strange, bizarre, and I suppose wonderful experience of falling in love, you know what it is. Falling in love psychologically is one of the strangest things that happens, because what seems to happen, there's person A with ego A, there's person B with ego B. These two people come together, and it's as though their egos merge or melt into each other. This is the experience of romantic love from a psychological perspective. Ego barriers, boundaries get fuzzy. And this happens in a small way for anyone that you're very fond of. You know, we become identified with those people. We become attached to those people, which means the boundary or barrier of where you end and the other person begins, those barriers get fuzzy. That happens all the time, anyone you're fond of or attached to. The barrier, where do you end, where do they begin, it's fuzzy. So in the maximum case, so to speak, of totally falling in love, what happens, these boundaries are so fuzzy between the two people that there's no way of distinguishing where does one person begin, where does the other person end. They become sort of metaphorically, I'll say, merged into each other. Suppose that happens with regard to God as opposed to with regard to a human being. We feel ourselves having boundaries. Suppose in our prayer life, our meditation, our worship, suppose we develop a very real sense of being intimately related to the God of the cosmos, Bhagavan. And suppose that anuraga, that love, is cultivated over a period of time. It strengthens, it grows. And as it grows, we, from a psychological standpoint, can go through the same stages of one falling in love, which is to say that first the boundaries become a little fuzzy. Where do you end? Where does God begin? And eventually the boundaries are so indistinct that there is a sense of being merged into the other, a condition that we've already described as a condition of being utterly non-separate from the other. The sense of being utterly non-separate from God is what we've been calling parabhakti. This is the goal. Parabhakti, being utterly non-separate from Bhagavan. How do you get there? Anuraga. Notice that the means of the three traditions are completely different, very different. Using jnana in Advaita Vedanta, using samadhi, meditation, for the sake of paravairagya in the yoga darshana, using our emotions in this school of bhakti. But notice where they culminate. They use different words. In Vedanta, we can talk about moksha or ahankara nasha. In yoga, we talk about kaivalya. And we've been talking extensively here about parabhakti. But don't they all refer to the same condition, the same state? When, just to illustrate this last one again, and in very simple terms, it's not, I hope I'm not making it sound too complicated. It's really not complicated. You are already non-separate from God, but you feel separate from God. What makes us feel separate from God? That's it. This is ahankara. This is that false I. When that false I is removed, notice this is absolutely in common in the three approaches. When that false I is removed, the sense of division, the sense of isolation and separation comes to an end. And that's the goal. Now, in the prior class, I tiptoed around the word surrender. But now we can talk about it in this last context. How does one begin with love and end with parabhakti, utter non-separation? What is being surrendered? There's a surrender involved, but what does it mean to surrender to God? We saw this in our last class, and I sidestepped the issue or question before. How is surrender a means in this process? Well, maybe it's clear that what's being surrendered in each of the three cases, what's being surrendered is a false I. What does it mean to surrender after all? Does surrender mean you wave a white flag and say, I give up? What does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. And even we talked in a prior class about falling before the altar and say, Bhagavan, I surrender my life to you. But then you get up and walk out the door and what's changed? You have exactly the same attitude after you've surrendered as you had before you surrendered. That's not surrender. What does it mean to surrender? What gets surrendered? That false I, that ego. And I think several classes ago, we talked about that beautiful image that and that was at Kabir Das, Doha, where he says that path, this bhakti marg, is very narrow. How narrow is it? There's only room for one. If you're on the path, there's no room for Bhagavan. But if you're not there, there's only Bhagavan. If ego, false I, is not there, there's only God. This is a culmination of bhakti, which is the same as a culmination of Advaita Vedanta, which is the same as a culmination of Yoga Darshana, and it specifically is the removal of the false I. We can call it surrender from a bhakti tradition. We can call it samadhi from this Yoga Darshana's point of view. We can call it ahankara nasha. What a nice connection. What's called ahankara nasha by the Advaitins is pretty much the same as what prapatti means to the bhaktas. Prapatti means surrender. So surrender, ahankara nasha, paravairagya, kaivalya, these all describe the same reality. All right, said. Now, let's see we can move on now, see some sutras. You can see why I suggested this is a very important sutra. The whole thing is here. So he begins, Kaha tarati maya? Who crosses maya? The one who, and we see the three levels, the one who develops a value for spiritual growth and gives up attachment. Then, the one who is on the journey and needs some guidance, seeks out that guidance of a mahanubhava, of a wise, experienced person, a guru. And then finally, nirmamaha bhavati, that person becomes free from mama, free from aham. That person becomes free from that false I, that false ego. And when the false ego is not there, what's left? In a very real sense, what's left is Bhagavan. To the extent you are there, to that extent Bhagavan is not. To the extent you are not there, you, the false you, to the extent that false you is not there, to that extent Bhagavan alone remains. All right. This is such an important sutra. When you look ahead, the next two or three sutras appear to be a commentary on this sutra. There's a style in some scriptures called self-commentary, where the author will write a statement and then will write a bunch of statements explaining that statement. Then he'll write another statement. Then he'll write a bunch of statements explaining the second statement. It's a style called self-commentary, auto-bhasha. And here we have what really amounts to a self-commentary, auto-commentary. So in 47, 48, and even part of 49 are explaining what we've seen in 46. Let's continue. Yo vivikta-sthanam sevate, yo vivikta-sthanam. Yo loka bandham unmulyati, loka bandham unmulayati, nistrai gunyo bhavati, yoga kshemam tyajati. You'll see this all relates to what we've just discussed. Yaha, one who, remember he's talking about yaha, kahatarati, who crosses. Who crosses maya? He continues to explain that. Yaha, one who, viviktasthanam sevate. One who sevate resorts to a sthana, a place. What kind of sthana? A viviktasthana, an isolated place, a separate place, a quiet place. One who resorts to a quiet place. Now, the most common image that comes, somebody imagines running off to the Himalayas and finding a nice cave. Of course, there's a problem I understand nowadays. Most of the caves are occupied. You might have to put your name on a waiting list, I suppose. But viviktasthana doesn't narrowly mean that kind of isolated life in an ashram or a cave. It means being alone with yourself for the sake of sadhana. That's what it's about. Why go to a cave in the Himalayas? If you go to that cave in the Himalayas and you bring your laptop with you, why is that? So you get the point that it's not the place that's important. It's the condition that's important. Suppose you go to your own prayer room. Many of you will have a puja room or an altar in your home. Do you bring your laptop to your puja room? Never. That is a viviktasthana. That's a place for your quiet. It's a place set aside for sadhana. When you go to a mandir, when you come here to the ashram, this is a viviktasthana. Not in the sense that it's lonely and isolated, but in the sense that it's a place where you are removed from worldly responsibilities and concerns and you're focused totally on spiritual growth. This is viviktasthana. So who is it that can gain this surrender, this enlightenment? Is one who, viviktasthanam sevate, one who resorts to a quiet place. Yaha loka bandham unmulayati. Loka bandham, the bondage of the worldly life. Loka bandham, the bondage of this world. One who unmulayati. Literally, unmulana is to rip something out by the roots. Like if there's a plant in the ground, you rip it out by the roots. What's significant about this? Many of you have a home with a garden or lawn. You know what happens when you chop off if you have a lawn, you have weeds, right? You have lots of nice weeds. Lawn is sort of healthy. Weeds are very healthy. So you come along in summer and you chop off all those weeds. Suppose you mow them off, they grow right back. You chop them off again, they grow right back again. And they continue to grow back until you get them out along with the root. And that's the same thing in spiritual life. We get rid of our problems, they keep coming back. Get rid of them again, they keep coming back until you go after the root of the problem. That's what we've been talking about here all the time. The root of the problem being that false I, ahankara. So this loka bandha, this bondage to the world, is ultimately due to, we said, mama, wherever there's my, I'm in trouble. The more I have, the more trouble I have. The less I have, I still have some trouble. So how to be free from worldly suffering? Only when mama is gone. When will mama be gone? When aham is gone. How to get rid of aham, that's the issue. That's what we're talking about here. So this is what it means, unmulayati, to remove by the roots. And the root of the problem is that false I, because it's that false I that creates the false sense of separation from God. So when that's ripped up from the roots, and then nistraigunyaha bhavati, the person becomes, bhavati becomes nistraigunya. Triguna, trigunya. Trigunya is from the three qualities, sattva, rajas, tamas, and without getting into a long technical discussion, these three gunas describe human nature. Nature of the body, nature of the mind, nature of the senses. One who's stuck, absolutely enmeshed with the body, mind, and senses, is enmeshed with these three gunas, sattva, rajas, tamas. But this person, one who gets rid of, ultimately, this false I, one who recognizes their separation from this body, mind, they become nistraigunya, free from the three qualities, gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. The three qualities belong to the body, belong to the mind, does not belong to Atma. Atma itself, your true nature itself, being nirguna, free from these three gunas. Finally, yoga kshemam tyajati. The person tyajati gives up, abandons what? A life of yoga and kshema. This is a technical term when it's used together like this. Yoga, in this expression, yoga means acquisition. In this expression, kshema means taking care of what you've acquired. And that seems to describe conventional life. Get lots of stuff and then take care of it. And you've already discovered the more things you acquire, the more stuff you have to take care of. And by this point in your life, you've got lots of stuff. You wonder why your life is not very simple, why your life is so complicated, and that is we encumber ourselves with so much stuff. This is conventional life. This is a life of yoga kshema, a life of acquiring things that we think will make us happy, but then having acquired them, now we have to protect them and take care of them. That's kshema. This is the worldly trap. Then he continues in Sutra 48. Yah karma palam tyajati, yah karma palam tyajati, karmani sanyasyati, karmani sanyasyati, tato nirdvandvo bhavati, tato nirdvandvo bhavati. Yaha, one who, karma palam, the fruits of one's actions, tyajati, one who gives up. One who gives up the fruits of action, remember this is still part of our auto-commentary, self-commentary. So what he's describing we're back to step one here. As long as you're seeking worldly goals are karmapalam. Nothing wrong with seeking worldly stuff, but it's all limited. What we seek in spiritual life is not karmapala. It's funny to put it in those terms, but it really is true. What we seek in spiritual life is not karmapala. Now, admittedly, coming to this class is karma. Meditation is karma. Prayer and puja is karma. All of our sadhana is karma. Then why is our goal not karma palam? And the reason is, whatever pala you get is proportional to the karma. Whatever pala you get is proportional to the karma. So for a small pala, you require a small karma. For a medium pala, you require a medium pala. And if your pala that you seek is reaching the infinite God of the cosmos, Bhagavan, what kind of karma will it take to get there? Can't get there like that. The goal we seek in spiritual life cannot be gained through karma. So karma palam tyajati, a person recognizing that mere karmas don't get us there. Then you might wonder, well, this is a little bit of logic, but it's perhaps pertinent. If karma pala won't get us there, then why do we bother with all these karmas? This class is a karma, puja, prayer is karma, karma yoga is karma. So why should we bother? If we admit karma won't get us to God, then why do we do all of this? The answer is already up here on the board. We don't have to reach God, do we? Since everything already is a manifestation of Brahman. What we're really trying to do is to remove the false I. The false I, is it finite or infinite? It's a thing. It's part of our human nature. It's part of our mind, our thinking apparatus. The false I is certainly finite. Therefore, that false I can be destroyed through finite karma. The infinite Bhagavan cannot be attained through finite karma. But destruction of the ego, ahankara, can indeed be accomplished through finite karma. Therefore, karma palam tyajati, give up seeking the fruits of actions. Karmani sanyasyati, sanyasyati, and you renounce, you give up karmani, actions. Two ways of understanding that. You give up actions for the sake of worldly life, action seeking worldly pleasure and goals. Or you can take it in a more traditional way. You give up Vaidika karma, rituals. You give up performing rituals. Now, please recall that Vedic rituals historically were done for worldly results. If you want a good crop, you do a ritual. If you want the birth of a son, you do another ritual. If you want good health and long life, you do another ritual. So the concept of Vedic rituals were rituals done for worldly reasons. Here, karmani could refer to these Vedic rituals, and sanyasiti, you give them up as well. Tataha, and then nirdvandvaha bhavati, and then you become free from dvandva. Dvandva here means a pair. To be free from pair is not just any pair. Usually they get very silly and just say cold and heat and all of this stuff. That's meaningless. The dvandva that counts. You've probably seen it described like that. You should become free from dvandvas. You should be free from worrying about if it's too hot or too cold. You should be free from worrying about is it too high, too low, too salty, not salty enough, blah, 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 blah. You should be free from all of that. Dvandva here has a much more fundamental meaning. Everything in the world falls into two categories. Everything and everyone falls into two categories. One category is what you like. The other category is what you don't like. That's the real dwandwa. That's the real pair. One part of it is everything in this universe that you like. Why do you like it? It makes you feel good. It brings some happiness. It helps you. And the other half of the universe falls into the other category. All right. So near dwandwa. Now, just to finish our self-commentary in verse 49, and Vedanapi sanyasyati, Vedanapi sanyasyati, kevalam avichinnanuragam, kevalam avichinnanuragam labhate. I think we'll just look at the first part of the sutra. Yaha vedan api sanyasyati. Yaha, one who sanyasyati, gives up, renounces. Vedan api. Even the Vedas? We're talking about the person who reaches the goal being parabhakti, and the one. He started off saying one who is free from attachment, one who seeks out a guide, free from minus, seeking out in an isolated place, becoming free from worldly bondage, becoming free from the three qualities of the body and mind, being free from acquisition and protection, not seeking karma pala, not going for Vedic rituals. And he says, Vedan api. Even the Vedas you give up, the Vedas in the sense of karmakanda. Karmakanda is the ritualistic part of the Veda. In our limited circle here, that is in an ashram where we study a lot of Vedanta, our exposure to the Veda is minuscule. We study some Upanishads, which are the tiniest part of the Veda. The vast majority of the material in the Veda, there are lots of very, very beautiful, profound, symbolic prayers, but most of the Veda is given to ritual. And most of those rituals have to do with gaining worldly goals and ends, and not spiritual goals and ends. So in this sense, Vedan api sanyasiti, that person even gives up the Vedas, the ritualistic portion of the Vedas, which are meant to lead you to worldly ends. All right. The last part of the sutra we'll save for the next class, because there's a lot to talk about there. Before we end this class, a couple of questions came by email. You're all free to, it's a nice way to communicate. You can always email me your questions. You can also leave them in the basket here in front. When we met last week, we talked about manushyatvam, birth as a human being, and we talked about it as being a rare privilege. Well, this person comments that given the status of so many people, how much harm they cause in life, how can you say it's such a privilege? How can you say that human life is so lofty? And the point here is made that animals don't kill for pleasure and enjoyment. But when you look at human behavior, you see absolutely bizarre things going on. The person says animals attack when threatened, but human beings? In fact, there's a key. What do you think is... People who do bizarre things, hurtful things, do you think they might feel threatened? I mean, just to use the brutal example today of the jihadist, the suicide bomber, and you think about that as being just a horribly cruel thing to do, why would that suicide bomber just today, you know, somebody... It, typical thing. In Baghdad, there are a bunch of laborers out on the street looking for work. Guy pulls up in a minivan and says, I suppose in Arabic, come on, I have some work for you. So they all crowd around a minivan, and moments later, 60 people are dead, and dozens more are seriously injured. This is the glory of the universe? Manushyatvam being the privilege, the highest privilege, is to be born as a human being. How can we explain it? Well, we recognize, as the author of this question did, animals only attack when they're threatened. And I suspect that these jihadis feel that threatened. Maybe not physically. They feel culturally threatened, their lifestyles are threatened, their values are threatened. Don't get me wrong, this isn't to justify anything. It's absolutely unjustifiable. But just to understand that they're behaving like animals in a corner. If you corner an animal, in fact, one of my jobs lately is we have some mice running around in the ashram. I have to catch them. So suppose I corner the little mouse. Now, the mouse is this big. I'm this big. So that mouse is going to be kind of shivering in the corner. But if I come a little close to it, what will that mice do? He'll bite me is what he'll do. He'll attack. Why? He feels threatened. Whether he can win or not, he's programmed to attack. Sadly, it plays out in human behavior as well. We are animals and we do attack when threatened. It's not a very savory part of human behavior, but we are animals. But then, given the fact that we live in this kind of world, what can we do? When we see, here we are engaged in this process of spiritual growth. We see so many horrible things going on around us in the world. What can we do? If you get on a plane and go to Iraq and you go out on the street and try to make peace, you're not likely to be successful, and more likely than not, you're going to be one of the next batch of victims. What can we do in a very practical way? When we live in a crazy world, a world where there's so many nasty things, what can we do? We can all do what we can, of course, and you can be part of some social organization, you can do charitable things, but here's a very obvious and practical suggestion. We can all become better people. At least if we become kinder, more understanding, more compassionate. Two things happen. One is we're not contributing to the problems of the world anymore. Too often, we all contribute to the problems of the world. We are a drain on the world's resources. We are a pain in the neck for certain people that we don't happen to get along with. We are a source of problems in the world. So at the very least, we can resolve, well, at least let me not be a problem to others. Let me live a responsible life, not creating an unnecessary demand. You know, is it really necessary to drive around in that giant Hummer SUV? Maybe it's not. So maybe we can be ecologically responsible. Certainly we become more compassionate and sensitive to others. And not only, there are two aspects, not only do we cease to cause harm in this world, but if we are better people, those who come in contact with us will be affected by our goodness, and it's kind of contagious in a good sense. Bad things are contagious. Good things can also be contagious. So if we become much more sensitive, much more caring, much more understanding, and we demonstrate that to all that we meet, then those people that we meet will be affected by our compassion and understanding. It will not only help them, but it'll help them transform themselves. We cannot change other people. You know that very well. what we can do, perhaps, is change ourselves. And through changing ourselves, I guess we change the world. It's the most practical way. That's one thing you can do and must do. You want a better world, at least make your corner of the world better. Your corner is yourself, your home, your family, your immediate corner of the world. All right. There are a few more questions that came. I think we'll save them for our next class, just so we don't get too late tonight. A few announcements before we conclude. This coming Friday, we have a concert. In fact, a very nice musical group coming called Bhakti Sangeet. There are five, six different musicians. I'm sure they'll give us a nice, wonderful performance of bhajan and kirtan. This is this coming Friday at 7:30. There's some flyers up on the board. Another important announcement. We're starting to get into the winter months now, when the weather gets bad and the roads get icy.